But who is responsible for your friends' deaths? Nothing from the man on the bed. You show no respect for our investigation, but perhaps you should. You are not a suspect. We know you fought against the attackers. The blood of one of the men found in the kitchen was all over your hands. I am not going to charge you with murder for that. You might be pleased to know. Dom rolled his eyes. He wasn't thinking about the implications for himself. I just want you to help me understand why they came for Arik Jacobi. I can't help you. I don't know. Naidu sighed. Pakistani terrorists. The threat of nuclear war. New conflict with China. Crime, corruption, disease. You don't think my nation has enough problems without armed Jews coming to our shores and encouraging new enemies? Do I get my phone call, or do you want an international incident when I leave? You get a phone call when I say you get a phone call. You leave when I say you leave. Do you always treat guests to your country with such warmth? Naidu laughed. I am not from the Tourism Bureau, Mr. John Doe. Maybe you can arrange an elephant ride with them when you get out of prison, but I am here to extract information from you. Prison? Naidu was flailing. Dom knew most everything there was to know about interrogation tactics. He'd been trained by the FBI, after all. He could tell there was something missing from the detective constable's bluster. The bark was there, but Dom sensed no bite. He smiled thinly. I can hear it in your voice. You are bluffing. You don't have the authority to do a damn thing to me. Naidu deflated a little. Though he kept his chin up and his voice strong, Dom saw weakness in his eyes. After a long staring contest, Naidu broke his gaze. I would like to keep you here. You would open your mouth eventually, I promise you this. But someone thinks you are important. A plane has arrived from the United States. My superiors have ordered me to put you on it as soon as you are fit for travel. With that, Caruso threw off the sheets and kicked his legs out over the side of the bed. He began sitting up, but he'd only flexed his abdominals when he recoiled in pain. It felt as if all his ribs had been broken, or at least very badly bruised. He dropped back flat on the bed. The detective constable cracked a slow smile as he noticed the young American's agony. He stood and walked to the door, then turned back, still with a smile only half hidden under his mustache. He said, "Forgive me, John Doe. In this situation, I must find my satisfaction in the little things." 4. Ethan Ross ran late for work almost every Monday, and today was no exception. He would never admit it, but arriving fashionably late was by design. He found punctuality to be beneath his station, and chronic tardiness nothing more than a harmless, passive-aggressive way to protest the inflexible rules of his organization. He'd slept in a little this morning, not at home in Georgetown, but at his girlfriend's place in Bethesda. Last night, he and Eve had gone out to a bar to watch a Lakers game that didn't end till after 11 here on the East Coast, and then they'd stayed for one more round that had somehow turned into 3. They'd finally made it to bed at 1, and to sleep at 2 after Ethan's amorous mood overpowered the 5 greyhounds he'd consumed. He'd planned on going home to spend the night at his own place, but after sex, all he wanted to do was roll over to the edge of the bed and crash until morning. At 8:15, Ethan awoke suddenly, roused by a panicked and shrill rendering of his name. "Ethan!" The voice was Eve's, and his eyes opened and fixed on her alarm clock, because she was holding it in front of his face. "Calm down," he said, but she was up and running for the bathroom because punctuality was more her thing than it was his. He made it downstairs to his red Mercedes coupe a few minutes later, cranked up some music, and drove south to his townhouse on 34th Street, where he indulged in a long, leisurely shower, and then took all the time he needed styling his blonde hair with molding clay. He dressed, then stepped in front of his full-length mirror so he could check the fit, cut, and sheen of his gray Ralph Lauren sharkskin suit. Satisfied that his purple polka-dot tie wasn't too much with the sharkskin, he slipped on a pair of cherry loafers and gave himself one more long appraisal in the mirror, assessing, and then approving his style and looks. At 9, he sauntered down the front steps of his row house, still unhurried and unstressed, and he climbed back into his warm Mercedes and headed off to work, music blaring again. Traffic on Wisconsin Avenue wasn't too bad, but he hit his first snag of the day when he found Pennsylvania to be mired in gridlock. While he crept forward, he sang along with his Blaupunkt stereo. Neil Young's On the Beach was a 1974 release that would have been a unique listening choice for most 32-year-olds, but Ross had grown up with it. Revolution music, his mother used to call it, although Ethan realized there was a certain dissonance to the concept of singing along with anti-establishment songs while driving his luxury car on his way to his government job. No matter. Ethan still considered himself something of a rebel, albeit one with a more realistic worldview. He'd been listening to his old albums since he got off work on Friday, both alone and then with Eve. She didn't much care for them, but she didn't complain, and he didn't really give a damn. Eve was a brilliant but hopelessly submissive Korean girl who would walk on glass for him if he told her to do so, and sometimes Ethan liked to unplug on the weekends, to go from 5 p.m. Friday to 9 a.m. Monday without checking his phone or his iPad or watching any TV. He didn't do it often, but there were times when his job was too stifling. Endless, boring meetings and conference calls and lunches with people he didn't want to eat with or trips with people he didn't want to travel with. He'd had a few months like this. His work was frustrating him and interfering with his well-cultivated self-image as a DC power player, and only detoxifying himself from work and inoculating himself with the music of his childhood could refresh him and get him ready to face work again on Monday. Eve didn't complain. Ethan was certain she was just happy to have him to herself for 2 full days. He checked his hair in the rear view, turned up Neil Young even louder, and sang along, pitching his voice in and out of key, and fighting the power the only prudent way to do so at present. Ethan Ross liked to tell people he worked at the White House, and it was true, with a caveat. His office was in the Dwight D. Eisenhower Executive Office Building, next to the West Wing, and while the Eisenhower EOB housed many offices for White House personnel, it wasn't, strictly speaking, the White House. West Wing employees distinguished themselves from Eisenhower Building employees by saying they worked inside the gates, while the EOB staff worked outside the gates. Ross didn't see any distinction himself. He was a White House staffer to anyone who asked, or anyone who would listen, for that matter. He had spent the last 3 years here, spanning 2 administrations, serving as Deputy Assistant Director for Near East and North African Affairs in the National Security Council. He prepared policy papers for the President of the United States, or at least he coordinated the preparation of policy papers for the National Security Advisor, who then determined if the President should see a summary of them. The papers came from the work of the Department of State and the U.S. intelligence community, as well as a series of domestic and international think tanks and academic institutions. His job, as he described it, was to give POTUS the best information available for him to conduct policy. But his job, as he actually saw it, was to push paper while others made key decisions. Ethan worked closely with the U.S. intelligence community, getting data from most all of the 16 agencies related to his region, not just the CIA, but also the National Reconnaissance Office, the National Geospatial Intelligence Agency, the Department of State's Bureau of Intelligence and Research, sometimes even the military intelligence agencies. Coordination was his role. He wasn't a decision-maker himself, but he did have his finger on the pulse of happenings in his region. It was a moderately high position for someone his age, although, as far as Ross was concerned, it was far beneath him. He had considered the work just barely impressive at 29 when he was put in the post, but now, 2 weeks before his 33rd birthday, each and every day he lamented what he saw as his slow rise to the ranks of the power players. His work no longer pushed him. Ethan thought he was smart enough to phone it in, and so that's exactly what he had been doing for some time. He hoped to advance out of this job soon, not into something higher at NSC. This had just been a placeholder for him. Rather, he wanted to make his way into the U.S. delegation to the United Nations. He had been bred for a life of high-level work in an international organization. His father had worked as a staffer in the UN for 25 years before becoming an international studies professor, both at universities abroad and then back home in Georgetown. His mother had served in the Carter administration as an undersecretary in the United States mission to the United Nations, then as ambassador to Jordan during the Clinton years, before herself becoming a professor at Georgetown and a best-selling author of political biographies. Just like every workday, Ethan parked his red E-Class coupe in a parking facility a block away from the Eisenhower building, and just like every workday, it pissed him off when he walked to the EOB and saw open parking spaces in the lot. His position did not merit a reserved parking space. Only the highest-ranking 24 or so execs had such privileges. He stepped through the gate at the 17th Street entrance, then pulled his badge out of his coat. He was late enough that the security line was short, so in under a minute he left the drab-gray outbuilding and headed up the steps into the main building. The Eisenhower EOB used to be known as the State War and Navy Building, and it had been the nexus of American foreign power at the end of the 19th century and the beginning of the 20th century, the era when America emerged as a world leader. It had been constructed over a 17-year period in the late 1800s and crafted in the ornate architectural style known as French Second Empire. The elaborate symmetrical iron cresting, balustrades, and cornices were meant to portray permanence and character, and many felt the huge structure in many ways overshadowed its next-door neighbor, the White House. Ethan wasn't as impressed with the architecture as others were, because he knew the Eisenhower building wasn't the power center it used to be, and certainly nothing like the building next door at 1600 Penn. He made it into the third floor NSC wing at 9:39, entered his small office, hung his coat on the rack, and frowned. His secretary, Angela, always had his coffee ready for him, a venti mocha from Starbucks that she picked up on her way into work and placed on his desk next to his telephone. Angela was here. He had seen her sweater hanging over the back of her chair in his outer office when he entered, but his coffee was nowhere to be found. Ross sighed. "You had one job, Angie, and you dropped the ball first thing on Monday morning." A moment later, he heard movement outside his office, and he called out as he sat down, "Angie?" His 54-year-old secretary appeared in the doorway a moment later. "Good, you're here." With both a look and a tone crafted to convey just a hint of displeasure, he said, "Did you forget my coffee?" "No, sir. I put it at your place in the conference room. Everyone else is waiting." Ethan jerked his head to his morning agenda lying on his blotter, worried he'd forgotten a meeting. Rarely did he have any planned events so early on a Monday. But his agenda confirmed he was free. I don't have anything till 10:30, and that's off-site. They said they were calling everyone on their way in. I thought you'd gotten the message. Ethan had heard his phone ring through the sound system in his Mercedes, but he'd muted the call without looking at it. The speakers had been pouring out Neil Young, after all, and by the time the last smoky notes of Ambulance Blues drifted away, he'd been pulling into the parking lot, and he'd forgotten about the call. What's going on? I don't know, but it must be a big deal. Everyone was supposed to be in the conference room at 9:30. Ethan looked at his watch. It was 9:41. He sighed again and headed off for the conference room. 5. Ethan entered the open double doors of the NSC conference room and saw a full house looking back at him. The U-shaped table was completely occupied, and it was standing room only against the walls. He knew the table could accommodate 16, so he estimated there were at least 25 in attendance. His venti mocha was right there on the table, but sitting in front of it was Walter Pack from the South and Central Asia desk, and Ross couldn't muster the gall to push his way through the crowd and grab his drink when all eyes were on him. As he headed for an open spot by the wall, he scanned faces quickly in an attempt to discern the reason for this morning's emergency meeting. He saw the deputy directors and assistant deputies for all the other regions, Europe, Russia and Eurasia, Asia, South Asia, Central Africa, even the Western Hemisphere. Whatever new problem had popped up seemed to be impossibly wide in scope. Ross half-smiled to himself, wondering if NASA had gotten word that aliens were poised to attack. He also noticed several men and women from the IT department. This, he considered, odd, but not especially so, as they were higher-level system administrators, and they found their way into many staff meetings when questions about access and networks came into play. He located a spot on a wall and then turned to face the front, and now he noticed someone who didn't belong. A fit-looking male in his late 30s wearing a dark blue suit stood at the front of the room behind Madeline Crossman and Henry Delvecchio, who were positioned side by side at the lectern and had obviously been addressing the group. Ethan didn't know Blue Suit Guy, but he did know Delvecchio and Crossman. Delvecchio was the deputy for regional affairs, the head of all the regions. He worked directly for the National Security Advisor, and that made him one of the top men in the NSC. Crossman, on the other hand, was not a big deal as far as Ethan was concerned. Any worries Ethan had that this was something of major import vanished the instant he saw Maddie Crossman standing at the lectern. She was a compliance and security director, an administrator in charge of making sure everyone filled out requisition forms correctly and didn't leave their key cards at their desks when they went to the John. Ethan gave a contrite half-wave at Crossman and Delvecchio and said, "Sorry, folks, car trouble." Henry Delvecchio gave an understanding nod and returned his attention to the room. "Again, I apologize for rushing everyone in first thing, but we have an issue that needs your attention. I trust you all have heard about the events in India last night." Ethan looked around to other faces. There were nods, clear indications of understanding. Ethan Ross, on the other hand, didn't have a clue what had happened in India. Suddenly he felt like he was back in his undergrad days, walking in late to class with a hangover, only to find out there would be a pop quiz, and he didn't have any idea of the topic of the test. The good news, as far as Ross was concerned, was that this wouldn't have a damn thing to do with him, as India wasn't his turf. Instinctively, he swiveled his head to Joy Bennett, assistant deputy director for India. That was her neck of the woods. He felt a little schadenfreude. He couldn't help it. He'd never thought much of Bennett. Let's see how she deals with whatever dust-up is going down over there. He found it strange, though, that Joy Bennett was looking back at him. Delvecchio continued, "The attack on the Jewish citizens on the Malabar coast was the first border incursion over water by terrorists since the massacres in India 2 years ago by Pakistani terrorists. And while the loss of life this time was just a small fraction of the earlier attacks, there are reasons to suspect this was not an attempt at a mass casualty event that failed, but rather this was a targeted killing of an Israeli national with key ties to the special operations community." There were a few gasps of surprise around the room. The perpetrators, and this has not made the news yet, were a mixture of Palestinian fedayeen and Yemeni jihadists working together, which is as unusual as it is troubling. In Ross's mind, alarm bells began going off. Israel, Palestinian, jihadi, attack. Christ! The fact he had spent the weekend away from his phone and computer had suddenly gone from smart to stupid in his mind, and Ross considered himself anything but stupid. Fuck! Delvecchio looked at Ethan's boss, the deputy director of Near East, who in turn looked to Ethan. He cleared his throat, nodded slowly and thoughtfully, and then bullshitted. "It is something we are looking at closely. Anything you want to add right off the bat?" Ross affected a distant look that was intended to portray thoughtfulness. Then he shook his head slowly. Delvecchio threw Ross a lifeline. He said, "You probably haven't had a chance to read the report from CIA. Just came over from Langley about 30 minutes ago. I was just about to pull it up when I heard we were meeting." Delvecchio filled in the pieces. "Maybe a dozen dead on Indian soil. 7 attackers. 3 attackers wore suicide vests. 1 vest detonated. It would be interesting even if the victims were nothing more than Israeli expats. But one of the victims was Colonel Arik Yaqobi, a former Israeli Defense Forces officer." The Assistant Deputy Director of Combating Terrorism Strategy spoke up. "Henry, there are tens of thousands of ex-IDF officers. Presumably thousands are outside Israel at any one time. All respect to the dead. But what's so damn interesting about this retired colonel?" Delvecchio answered, "Colonel Yaqobi was the former leader of a group of Israeli naval commandos." He looked down to a sheet of paper on the lectern in front of him. "Shayatet 13. The ADD of CTS nodded thoughtfully. "Got it." Delvecchio said, "Most of you remember the attack on the Turkish aid flotilla off the coast of Gaza 4 years ago. Shayatet 13 was the unit that boarded the Turkish freighter, the SS Ardahan. According to the CIA, Colonel Yaqobi led the boarding party. If you remember, 9 Palestinians were killed in the raid, including 3 combatant commanders of the Al-Qassam brigades." Delvecchio paused for effect, then added, "Which is the same unit the CIA believes orchestrated the attack in India over the weekend." He paused to shuffle some papers on the lectern, and while he did so, the ADD of Combating Terrorism Strategy asked, "How does CIA know Yaqobi was part of the IDF raid on the Turkish ship?" "Our friends at Langley had a paid informant on the SS Ardahan. This agent passed crucial intelligence about the security of the ship to his handler, and then, after conferring here with the NSC, POTUS ordered the CIA to feed the intelligence on to the Israelis. In the back and forth of this communication, A meeting occurred in Tel Aviv between CIA officers and Sheyatet 13 commandos, including Colonel Jacoby. His name made it into the CIA database after the meeting. After the flotilla raid by Sheyatet 13, the CIA wrote up an after-action review for internal dissemination. Delvecchio paused. Colonel Jacoby's name was put in the AAR. He added, "In error." Someone, Ross thought it was Pak from South and Central Asia, said, "That is a significant error." "Agreed," Delvecchio said. "It should have been redacted and code-worded. It wasn't our file. We didn't do it." He hastened to add, "Not that it matters to Colonel Jacoby and his family." Madeline Crossman, the compliance and security director, said, "We have serious concerns. The Palestinian terrorists learned Mr. Jacoby's name from the CIA report." Beth Morris spoke up. She was assistant deputy director for Western Hemisphere. "I'm sorry, Henry, Madeline. Is there some linkage here with NSC that I don't understand?" Henry Delvecchio nodded. "Beth, we have reason to believe there has been an insider compromise." There were soft gasps throughout the room. When they subsided, he said, "The complete CIA file on the SS Ardahan, including the name of the Sheyatet 13 team leader, was accessed on the network here in the NSC office 4 months ago. The files were copied and moved into a file-sharing section of the server. From there, we can only assume they were printed out or downloaded." Morris asked, "They were accessed by who?" Crossman said, "We do not know. There was a breach of 45 documents classified at the secret level or above. Whoever moved the files disguised the electronic fingerprint of the breach." Morris's voice rose in indignation. "And you think one of us stole the files and gave them to the Al-Qassam brigades?" Crossman replied, "Beth, there was, without question, anomalous behavior. That's all we know at this point for sure. We need to rule out any nefarious actions." Morris looked over to the IT staffers in the room, who were all more or less sitting together. It had to have been someone who knew how to disguise the electronic fingerprint, whatever the hell that is. The entire IT department bristled at the comment, but they were generally quieter than the regional staffers. One of them said, "These files were taken off JWICS." JWICS was the Joint Worldwide Intelligence Communications System, an internet of sorts for America's intelligence agencies. "Yes, that's correct," confirmed Crossman. "Specifically, the files were accessed on Interlink TS. This was a top-secret network that ran on JWICS." "How many people had access to the TS files?" "Including staffers and IT administrators, and adding in those outside contractors with access to both the TS files and the NSC terminals? 34. Ethan Ross looked around the room, but while he was counting heads, Beth Morris spoke up again. "Is everyone who could have accessed it here?" 31 are here, actually. One sysadmin called in sick today, and 2 are on vacation. One is traveling abroad. I don't have to tell anyone here that we take this breach incredibly seriously. More so now that it is quite possible lives have been lost due to the compromise." The room came alive with crosstalk. Pak, the ADD from Asia, asked, "Do we know it was our leak that caused it? How do we know the Israelis don't have a compromise of their own, or that the information about Jacoby could have been obtained some other way?" Delvecchio said, "No, we do not know our leak led to the deaths in India. But it doesn't look good. Another file in the cache taken was a follow-up review of the CIA's involvement in the raid, done just last year. This file did not mention Jacoby by name, but it stated the Shayatek colonel who led the raid had retired and moved to Paravur, India. One of the staffers shook her head in disbelief.
Why the hell would they put that in the file?
Apparently, CIA's National Clandestine Service contracted the retired colonel for training purposes. He was some sort of a martial artist. The file said he could be reached to contribute to the review, although in the end, he was never contacted. Delvecchio cleared his throat. The two pieces of the puzzle the Palestinians would need for yesterday's assassination, those being the man's name and his location, were both in the digital breach from the NSC. Again, we don't know that's how the Palestinians got the intel, but the president has been notified, and he has already made the decision to tell the Israeli prime minister about the compromise, so we need answers immediately. Ethan Ross spoke up now.
Henry, you can be certain my department will conduct a full security review. I'm sure the other desks will conduct their own reviews.
Crossman spoke up before Delvecchio could answer.
That won't be necessary.
It's protocol, said Ethan.
It is protocol.
But for a matter this delicate, where there is a possibility of a high-level leak of classified information, the security review will be conducted by DOJ. This flies way above desk level, Ethan.
There was some shock, a fresh din of indignant comments around the room. One of the IT guys mumbled something about the computer system's antiquated architecture and weak safeguards against an inside attack. Another systems administrator tried to ask technical questions about the breach, but Crossman shut him down, saying the ongoing investigation precluded her from answering specifics. After several moments, the murmurs in the conference room rose, and neither Henry Delvecchio nor Madeline Crossman seemed able to take back control. The fit man in the dark blue suit who had been standing silently behind them stepped to the lectern. Ethan thought he had a Clark Kent hairstyle and a build like an amateur bodybuilder. Under his breath, Ethan muttered, "Oh, shit. It's a G." Beth Morris's tone was almost derisive as she asked, "And who are you?"
"Supervisory Special Agent Darren Albright, FBI Counterintelligence Division."
"CID? Oh, my God," mumbled Morris. "We are being treated like criminals."
Albright shook his head calmly. His voice was soft but powerful, like a man indulgent of others, but barely so.
"No, ma'am, you are not being treated like criminals. Trust me." He eyed the room. "This isn't how we treat criminals. I am working with Director Delvecchio to organize the polygraphs we've ordered in a manner that is least intrusive to the important work everyone here is doing."
Morris snorted.
"If you aren't treating us like criminals, what do you call dragging us into FBI polygraphs?"
Albright spoke politely, but he didn't smile. To Ross, he didn't seem the smiling type.
"I call it treating you like suspects. Criminals are cuffed and frog-marched to jail."
The room flew into a barely controlled and sustained rage at the comment. Beth Morris was the most vocal of the group. Albright conferred with Madeline Crossman softly, but Ethan could hear him ask her Beth Morris's name. Unsurprisingly to Ethan, Crossman gave it with a little sneer. She was the office hall monitor, after all. Albright said, "Mrs. Morris, forgive me for saying so, but you certainly have a lot of concerns about this polygraph. Would you like to talk to me in private after the meeting breaks up?" Beth glared at both Albright and Crossman. Finally, she said, "I have no problem taking another poly. We all hold security clearance, and that goes with the territory. I do take issue with the fact we're sitting here with the FBI. NSC has its own security protocols."
Albright just smiled at Beth Morris. Then he addressed the room. Don't mind me, folks. I'll be poking around a bit for the next few days, but you won't even know I'm here. You will have your pollies. Then everyone can get back to work. He added, almost everyone, that is. The person responsible for the data breach will have some questions to answer. The meeting broke up soon after this, and Ethan returned to his office, passing his curious secretary with neither a glance nor a word. He immediately pulled up the CIA report on the India attack on his computer and spent several minutes reading it over and over and over. 20 minutes later, he passed through his secretary's office again, this time on his way out the door. He wore his overcoat, and his car keys were dangling from his hand, even though he had a 10-minute walk back to his car. He noticed Angie looking at him with surprise. It was only 10:30, after all. Early for lunch, even in Washington. Running out for my 10:30 meeting. Coffee with a consular official up in DuPont. Hold my calls. 6. Dominic Caruso arrived at Kochi's Cochin International Airport in the back of an ambulance. It was the middle of the night, and traffic was light both on the highway to the airport and on the grounds, which worked to the advantage of both the Indian government and the people who sent the plane to pick him up. Dom spent the ride prone, with his wrist handcuffed to the arm of his gurney. He assumed he had Detective Constable Naidu to thank for his jewelry. It was a last show of displeasure and passive aggression from the law enforcement officer who'd been ordered by government superiors to send his one witness to a terrorist act on his way without any semblance of a proper interrogation. Dom didn't think much of Naidu personally. He was at least an asshole, and it seemed to Dom that he was an anti-Semite as well. But Dom did have to allow for the fact that he understood the Indian policeman's frustration with losing his witness. Dom had been an FBI agent, was still officially in the FBI, on paper anyway, and he knew that had he been in Naidu's shoes, working a crucial case with an eyewitness in his hands, and then received a call from some shadowy and powerful superior telling him to ship said key witness out of the country immediately, it would piss him off no end. And Dominic also knew he was not above a little payback, perhaps in a manner similar to how Naidu treated him. Dom rattled his handcuff a little, but then let his hand drop back down to the gurney. The ambulance stopped, and Dom was wheeled out and pushed along a hot tarmac glowing and buzzing with electric lighting. He could hear the whine of finely tuned jet engines, and he thought that he knew exactly the make and model of the aircraft here to take him home, though he could not be certain. Soon he heard voices, but from his vantage point he couldn't see who was talking, nor could he hear what was being said. A police officer uncuffed his wrist. Then he saw another figure approach from behind. An attractive blonde with her hair in a tight bun leaned over him. Dom was relieved to see Adara Sherman, the transportation director for his organization, and immediately he felt like this ordeal in India had come to an end. Adara did not speak directly to Dom, but this was no surprise. Dom had been around Adara regularly for more than 2 years, and he knew her to be polite, but he also knew her to be all business, all the time. Their boss, Jerry Handley, had warned Dom and the other young single men in the organization that Adara was off-limits. Even so, Dom and his mates, on occasion, had tried to at least establish a friendly camaraderie with her. But whenever Dom or the others attempted to establish a rapport with her, even in the most jocular and non-threatening manner, their efforts were met with stark professionalism. She wasn't cold, really. But she was most definitely not warm. Adara Sherman looked Dom over in a manner that seemed to Dom like she was checking to make sure she had the right piece of luggage. She gave a quick nod to the two ambulance personnel and the two policemen and said, "I need you to put him on the plane, if you will. There is a sofa I have prepped as a bed in back." "Yes, ma'am," one of the attendants replied. Dom started to sit up on his own, but Adara put her hand firmly on his shoulder and pushed him back down flat without saying a word. He knew he could have gotten up and walked on board himself. It would have hurt, but he'd prefer it to being carried up on a gurney. Still, he wasn't going to fight Adara Sherman to do it. He had no doubt these locals thought she was just the good-looking stewardess on a ritzy corporate jet, but Dom knew something these boys didn't know. He knew where to look on her blue blazer to see the very faint imprint of a .40-caliber Sig Sauer pistol in her waistband, and he knew she kept an HK MP7 personal defense weapon stashed in a hidden spring-loaded locker just inside the galley opposite the door, and she was trained to deploy the weapon and address threats to the aircraft in under 3 seconds. Sherman was both a flight attendant and a transportation coordinator, but she was a hell of a lot more than that, and Dom knew better than to go against her wishes. Adara stepped out of the way, and Dom felt the gurney being lifted and carried through the hatch of the Hendley Associates Gulfstream G550. The medics deposited him on the sofa. They weren't particularly gentle with him, and his ribcage felt every jostle and twist. They let his legs hang off to the side. Then they left the aircraft after a quick look around at the beautiful high-end furnishings. Dom noticed one of the police officers had boarded as well, and this man stayed behind. After the men from the ambulance had deplaned and Dom was alone in the cabin with the cop, the Indian leaned over the American and said, "Naidu wanted me to tell you to give him a call sometime, if you ever have any information." Dom shrugged. It hurt his bruised ribs to do it. "You tell him I appreciate his hospitality." And then he waited for the man to leave. The cop deplaned behind the medics and stood outside on the tarmac talking to Sherman for a moment. Dominic took the time to pull himself up to a sitting position. He grunted and groaned with the sharp pain in his ribs and the dull aching in his head, but in no time he was on his feet, heading for the galley at the front of the plane. He wanted to fix himself a drink. He was halfway up the length of the cabin when Sherman entered the aircraft. She saw him standing and pointed to the sofa bed. "I need you on your back right now, please." "Can I grab a quick—" "No, you may not. Lie down. I'll take care of everything once we're airborne. Right now, we need to go." Dom reluctantly returned to the couch, but he found he had more trouble sitting back down than he had standing. Sherman was by his side immediately, helping him down onto his back. She then lifted his legs and put them on the sofa, covering them with a blanket. He breathed a long, relieved sigh. Having his feet up reduced the pain in his ribs considerably.
"Thanks."
She did not reply. Instead, she buckled him into the sofa bed, moved quickly to the hatch and shut it, then conferred with the pilot and co-pilot for a moment. Within a minute, the aircraft was moving, and Adara was back in the cabin, buckling herself into a jump seat by the door. As Dom lay on his back during takeoff, it occurred to him that this was not the first time he'd been injured and strapped down to this exact same sofa. He'd been shot in Pakistan a couple years earlier, and the long flight home had been an uncomfortable one. This time his wounds were not as severe, but there was another key difference between the two events. Back then, the mood on the flight home had been ebullient. He and his teammates had just prevented a nuclear detonation, and it seemed his wound had been a small price to pay for the success of the operation. This time, he was going home knowing a family of four, people he had come to care for a great deal, had died a fiery death. And he had a feeling he would be second-guessing his every action and reaction during the fight for a long time to come. The Gulf Stream leveled off over India, heading east toward the Bay of Bengal. Their flight plan would take them over Thailand and Taiwan, then over the Pacific Ocean to the U.S. West Coast. They'd stop in San Diego to refuel, and then fly the rest of the way back to the aircraft's home base of Baltimore, arriving 16 hours after departing Kochi. 5 minutes after takeoff, Adara returned to Dominic, who continued to feel like a piece of luggage. In an attempt to push the image out of his mind, he decided to press the issue of getting a drink.
Adara, I could use a maker's mark on the rocks.
She knelt down and unfastened the restraining straps on the sofa, then began unbuttoning his shirt.
Sorry, it will have to wait.
You don't need a stewardess right now as much as you need a medic. I'm going to check you out, see what we need waiting for us back in D.C. I had the Indian hospital email me your films and assessment, and I looked them over during takeoff. Nothing broken, but I want to look at the bruising on your chest. Dominic reacted with restrained anger.
I'm fine, Sherman. I've spent an entire day in the hospital. I've been evaluated.
Not by me, you haven't.
All I need is a drink and to be left alone.
But Adara Sherman did not back down. If you are going to be an asshole about this, it will only take longer for me to do what I need to do. She paused, and her tone softened slightly.
This is my job, Dominic. Now be a big boy, and let me check you out.
Dom realized he was taking out his frustrations on Adara. He slowly sat up enough for her to get his shirt off.
I'm sorry.
Tough couple of days. She looked at his bruised torso. The right side of his ribcage was black and blue.
Yeah, I'd say so. What happened here?
Fell down some stairs. Think I might have hit something on the way down.
She cracked a little smile.
What gave you your first clue?
After unwrapping the bandage on his chest and cleaning and debriding the puncture wound there, she did the same with his bandaged forearm. She then directed her attention to cleaning some smaller cuts and scrapes on his chest with antiseptic.
You don't trust the Indian doctors?
I trust them fine. But one thing I learned in Afghanistan, wounds can't be too clean.
Dom knew the woman had been a Navy corpsman, which in her case had not meant sitting on a ship passing out Dramamine. She had served in both Iraq and Afghanistan, treating U.S. Marines, sometimes under fire herself. Dom had seen a lot of action in his years with the campus, but he thought it was possible, even likely, that the attractive flight attendant had seen much more. Dom asked,
"Do you still think about it? The war?"
He was almost certain he would get some sort of professional non-response. But instead she stopped cleaning his wound for a moment. The cotton swab remained motionless, just barely brushing the damaged flesh on his chest. She looked him in the eyes.
Only every day.
Her eyes flicked away from his quickly. He could see her admonishing herself for her breach of professional distance, and she continued cleaning the abrasions without speaking.
He winced with pain from time to time, but mostly he sat there quietly.
When she finished the examination and the re-cleaning and re-bandaging of his wounds, she left for a moment and returned with some painkillers and a bottle of water.
No, thanks, Dom said.
Are you hurting?
Headaches. Not bad.
She held out the pills again, and Dom shook his head.
I need to think.
Can't think on those.
How about I make you that drink?
He cracked his first smile in 24 hours, though it wasn't much.
If you insist.
10 minutes later, Adara moved up the darkened cabin and stood over Dominic, who now reclined on one of the leather captain's chairs in the rear of the cabin. She used the light from a satellite phone to illuminate his face, expecting to find him already sound asleep. Instead, his dark eyes were wide open and full of intensity, and they looked up at her. She held the phone out.
It's Mr. Hindley. Dom took the phone and checked the time on a clock by the chair.
Hey, Jerry.
Jerry Hendley, director of both Hendley Associates, the financial management firm that served as the Whiteside front for the campus, and the campus itself, was a former South Carolina senator with a deep southern drawl.
How you holding up, Dominic?
I'm sure Ms. Sherman gave you the complete rundown of my injuries.
She did. I'm asking you.
I feel like I've been run over by a bus, but I'll be fine. He paused.
You have any intel on what went down?
Figured that was all you'd care about, so I've been digging. Fred, I don't have too much just yet. I talked to some friends at Langley. We know at least some of the terrorists were members of the Al-Qassam Brigades. They set sail from Yemen 5 days ago and hijacked an Indian cargo ship to move unmolested through Indian waters. Dom leaned his head back on the leather couch and closed his eyes.
Al-Qassam. Fucking Hamas.
That's right. Do we know why they targeted Yacoby? Jerry said no, but I'm reaching out to my sources here in the U.S. and abroad to get an answer. All I know at this point is that Yacoby had served until fairly recently as a commander in Shayatet 13.
An Israeli naval commando?
That explains a lot of the training he was putting me through. He had a thought.
Al-Qassam is Hamas's army. They are more or less conventional forces. When did they start using suicide vests?
Never. Due to the fact their op began in Yemen, we're entertaining the possibility the guys with the vests were Al-Qaeda.
Yacoby was one man, living abroad with his family, basically a soft target. Why would Al-Qassam use suicide bombers along with their gunmen?
There is a lot of speculation about that. One theory, and it does make some sense to me, is that the plan was to assassinate Yacoby and then go take hostages at the synagogue or some other place where the Jewish people in the community congregated. The Al-Qaeda in the vests would martyr themselves, take as many Jews as they could, and the Palestinians would escape.
Dom nodded. And this would mask an assassination.
Exactly. They could make it look like Arik and his family got caught up in a jihadist attack on Jewry in the area, and not targeted specifically by the guys from Gaza.
Dom thought about it for a moment. Make it look random? To protect whoever passed the intel about Yacoby and his whereabouts?
Possibly. I don't know. Let's not over-speculate.
Fair point.
Dom picked at the bandage on his arm, then said,
The more important question is, how did they find out about him?
Jerry said, Unknown at this point. I wonder if the Israelis have a traitor on their hands.
Shit,
mumbled Dom. Then he said,
You know what, Jerry? I was about 2 seconds away from getting a gun sight on the back of the suicide bomber's skull. I could have prevented their deaths.
Don't think like that. I know you did a hell of a job. The report from the Indians is you killed multiple attackers yourself.
Dom wasn't listening. His mind was back at the Yacoby's farm. Arik had 2 boys.
I know, son. I know. If I'd made it upstairs a little faster, I just might have.
Hendley's southern drawl boomed over the sat phone. You just might have been blown to bits with the rest of them.
Look, Dom, I can't tell you how to get past this.
I'm sorry, but I don't know.
After a pause, he said, You've been through this sort of thing before. Dom had been through this sort of thing before. His twin brother Brian, also an operative for the campus, had died in his arms more than 2 years earlier. Dom knew he had changed since his brother's death, and he feared the changes weren't for the better.
With Brian, you mean?
Yes.
I was the one who sent you and your brother to Libya. That weighs on me every day.
Dom countered without reservation, because he'd never blamed Jerry for what happened.
You made the right call. What we were doing needed to be done. Brian just got the short end of the stick.
And so did Arik Yakubi and his family. There's nothing you can do about it, and no sense replaying that night over in your mind for the rest of your life.
Yes, sir.
Caruso forced the thoughts of the dead family in India out of his head.
What's the fallout going to be for the campus on this?
Hard to say. We don't know how Al-Qassam knew about Yakubi, so we can't gauge your exposure yet.
Dom knew what Hendley was thinking.
Until you know how the intel got out about him and his location, you don't know if I've been burned as well. For now, I need to stay away from the campus. From the guys.
Jerry said, shouldn't be hard to do. The rest of the team is spread out around the world.
I'll keep everyone where they are, but you take some time off. Just take it easy.
Dom chuckled into the sat phone, but his heart wasn't in the chuckle.
I was already on stand down before this happened. Now you're telling me to get lost.
No. I'm telling you to get better.
Ms. Sherman tells me you'll need some recovery time. While you're doing that, this situation will subside. I can instruct the pilots to take you wherever you want to go. You wanted Dara to find you a resort hotel somewhere in the Rockies, a beach house in Hawaii, someplace you can take it easy until everything blows over.
Honestly, Jerry, I just want to go home. Back to D.C.
Fair enough. Get some rest. Adara will take care of you.
7. Harlan Banfield was a print journalist by trade. He'd been at it for more than 40 years, and he certainly looked the part. He was small and frumpy, with permanently messy silver hair and bright gray eyes that conveyed kindness and empathy, even when they were locked on a politician he was interviewing for the purposes of writing an excoriating hit piece. Harlan's day had begun in College Park, Maryland, at a morning meeting for an association of foreign correspondents. He'd been a foreign correspondent himself, with bylines from places as far away as Ho Chi Minh City and Montevideo, and even though he had settled down much in the past few years and rooted himself firmly to the D.C. area, he still liked to get together with other current and former globe-trotting reporters at the monthly breakfast. The meeting broke up at 11 a.m., and soon after Harlan climbed into his 9-year-old Volkswagen and made the drive down to his one-room office in a high-rise on K Street, deep in the district's downtown Golden Triangle. He had a morning of phone calls ahead before he had to head back out to lunch with old colleagues at the Washington Post. Banfield's career began working the city beat for the Philadelphia Inquirer in the 70s. He served in New York with UPI in the 80s, before finally taking work as a foreign correspondent for the Washington Post. He was based in Europe and the Middle East, primarily, but he was both an excellent journalist and a single man without a family, so he was sent to all the hot spots for 20 years before returning to D.C. to work at the Post's office on 15th Street in the twilight of his career. Banfield was 66 now, but he had not retired. He still did some freelance work around town, writing mostly for various electronic media outlets. In addition to his work for hire, Banfield also authored a blog about D.C. lobbyists, from a decidedly anti-D.C. lobbyist perspective. His blog got him some small attention inside the Beltway, but he wasn't doing it for the mainstream, because Banfield's blog, like his sporadic freelance work, was, by and large, a front. In truth, Harlan Banfield was much more than a journalist. He was also the U.S. liaison of an organization that called itself the International Transparency Project. The ITP's website put their mission statement succinctly, identifying the group as a loose, worldwide consortium of philanthropists, journalists, lawyers, and activists who endeavored to support government openness and accountability. They did this by seeking out, encouraging, funding, and protecting whistleblowers. The homepage of the ITP's website displayed a picture of a sunrise over Washington, D.C., with the phrase, "Truth versus Power," in bold type above it. There was something telling about having D.C. on the homepage of the website. The organization was